I mentioned at the outset, next week, Mr. Chairman, will be a quorum itself. So there will be no share. We will meet again, Mr. Chairman, in 2 weeks' time, which is a week after Purim. That's a week of recovery time, which I think is a fair amount. And in the meanwhile, let us devote our attention this evening to Purim-related matters. And we'll begin with a Dvar Halacha. And I'd like to talk about perhaps one of the mitzvahs of the day, and it is one of the mitzvahs of the day, which probably receives the least halachic airtime, either because people already feel that they know what to do, or they just do what they've seen done. But when it comes to the Megillah, there's plenty of halachas and matanas levyonim, there's many discussions, mishloach manos, also discussed extensively, and that brings us to the fourth of the mitzvahs of the day, and that is the Seuda itself, the Purim Seuda, and it is sourced in the Torah, pardon me, in the Megillah. The Megillah describes and moreover defines the days of Purim as Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha. It goes on to say Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha U'Mishloach Manos U'Matanos Levyonim. It is there are days of all of those things, but they are Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha, and we'll take a look, Mitz Hashem, at the halachas of the Mishteh, halachas of Simcha, and how the two is Simcha goes together with the Mishteh, and there are a number of aspects to talk about. Firstly, the Gemara itself discusses the Seuda, it seems purely in terms of the time, the timing of the Seuda. That is to say, the Gemara emphasizes that the mitzvah of Seuda is specifically during the day. That is to say, not the night before. Although we're quite familiar with the Megillah reading at night and day, that shouldn't give us to understand that the mitzvahs of Purim generally apply in the night and the day. They don't. Megillah is an exception. And moreover, the reading of the Megillah at night actually comes from a completely different source. The Gemara derives it from other psukim in Tehillim. That's the exception. But the rule is the mitzvahs of Purim apply only during the day. Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha. The Gemara emphasizes that it's specifically for the day. And that's important with regards to all of the mitzvahs. Mishloach Manos specifically should be given and received by day. Matanas Levyonim. And so too, Seudas Purim. Interestingly, there's an Ashkenazi minhag to have something of a Seuda on Purim night. It's based on certain sources, and either people do or they don't, but the Ramah does say to have a ktsas, laharbos ktsas besuda. It's difficult to quantify these things. What's a Seuda? What's being marbe a lot in a Seuda? And what's being marbe ktsas in a Seuda? But nonetheless, that is mentioned in the Ramah. But with regards to the actual Seuda itself, the timing, it's for this reason that the Ramah also says that the bulk of the Seuda, shall we say, should actually be in the day. The Seuda typically goes, spills, dare I use the expression, into the night. But the Iker of the Seuda should be by day. The point is that it shouldn't be like Shalshudas, that you just start 5 minutes before Shkia, and then most of it is really a Malava Malka or the Purim equivalent thereof. Rather, the Iker of the Seuda should be in the day. And actually, there are a number of Rishonim and Poskim that their minhag was to have the Purim Seuda in the morning. The Trumas HaDeshen says that was his minhag, and the Shalah Kodesh also. I don't think that's the mainstream minhag. Anyone who's that organized deserves to have a Seuda at that time, for sure. But for most people, it's in the afternoon, but it should be with plenty of time yet of Purim yet to go. So that's the Gemara's discussion. It seems to limit itself with regards to the Seuda, to the timing of the Seuda. But now, let us take a look at the pieces of the Seuda, the parts of the Seuda. What comprises it? What are the indispensables? Well, when we think of the term Seuda, I think, we think bread. Lechem levav enosh yisad. And on Yom Tov, there's going to be lechem sheni. There's no din of lechem sheni. But the question is there a lechem rishon when it comes to Purim? The Rambam formulates the mitzvah of the Suda as follows. This is in Hilchos Megillah, what is known. It's incidentally a very interesting question that has occupied many. The Rambam combines Chanukah and Purim together, and he calls the halakhas Hilchos Chanukah u'Megillah, which is interesting, because Chanukah is a time and Megillah is a sefer, which you read on Purim. But he didn't call them Hilchos Chanukah u'Purim or Hilchos Menorah and Megillah. He called them Hilchos Chanukah u'Megillah. Well, that's perhaps something to ponder. But in Perek Beis of Hilchos Megillah, Halacha Tet Vav, the Rambam writes, Ketzad chova su'uda zo? How does one fulfill this su'uda? Sheyochal basar, he should eat meat. Bitakin su'uda na'ah kefi asher timtzo yado. He should arrange as he can. And in terms of food, that's it. The only food the Rambam mentions as the chiyuv of the su'uda is basar. It's meat, a fleishika meal. The Rambam did not mention bread at all. And in fact, the poskim who discussed this Rambam head in two completely opposite directions as to how to understand what the Rambam meant by not talking about bread. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in his Perush Mor Ukutziah to the Torah, says one needs to have bread at the Suda, obviously. In fact, it's so obvious that the Rambam didn't even mention it, as if to say, as soon as you say the word Su'uda, that presupposes and incorporates the mitzvah of bread. I mean, that's the staple of the Suda. The Rambam just told you what else you need. And therefore, that's the opinion of Rabbi Yaakov Emden and his school, that that's certainly a chiyuv. On the other hand, the Magen Avraham and others take it as a simple matter that there is no obligation to have bread at the Purim Suda. And if we may get perhaps to the root of the matter, why would there yes and why would there no, and why would Purim be different than any other time that there's a chiyuv of Suda? So we must appreciate that all of the su'udas that we are familiar with are su'udas of Shabbos and Yom Tov. Now, Shabbos and Yom Tov have special mitzvahs, which are called Kovod Shabbos, Kovod Yom Tov, Oneg Shabbos, Oneg Yom Tov. And Tosfos state that the requirement of bread, which is really the chashivus, right, it gives it that standing, really derives from the chiyuv of Kovod and Oneg, so because that's how you mechaber the day, you give it that significance by having a bread-based meal, a challah-based meal, and therefore that's something that applies specifically to Yom Tov. Purim is not a Yom Tov, and in fact, there's an interesting background to Purim not being a Yom Tov, because actually, if you look in the Megillat Esther, which you will, it's Hashem soon. You will hear that there is a pasuk which actually describes it as a Yom Tov in Perek Tes, that they made them as Yemei Mishte v'Yom Tov u'Mishloach Monos Ish L'Re'ehu. And then there is a subsequent pasuk which describes it as Yemei Mishte v'Simcha Mishloach Monos Matonos Levyonim and does not mention it as a Yom Tov. And the Gemara in Maseches Megillah on Daf Hei actually states that originally it was proposed as a Yom Tov, it was presented as a Yom Tov, and it was not accepted as a Yom Tov by whoever didn't accept it, so much so that in the end it was just the Yom Tov got phased out. So that's very interesting, and that's really deserves its own discussion. Who was it that decided that it shouldn't be a Yom Tov, and why not, and who thought it should be in the first place? But Tachlis, Purim therefore does not have the status of a Yom Tov. The mitzvahs of Purim are Yemei Mishte v'Simcha. So now the question is, what type of su'uda is required in order to fulfill Mishte and Simcha? And Rabbi Kiva Eger maintains that the bread which really derives from the mitzvahs of Kavod and Oneg is not a mitzvah that relates to Simcha. And he demonstrates it, interestingly, from the fact that on Chol HaMoed, both of Sukkos and on Pesach, there's the mitzvah of Simcha. The mitzvah of V'samachta b'chagecha applies equally to every single day of those Moadim. It is applicable to Chol HaMoed as it is to the Moed itself. So Chol HaMoed is Chag, but it's not a Yom Tov. And the halacha actually is that there is no mitzvah to have a bread-based seuda on Chol HaMoed. And therefore, and from there you see that simcha doesn't generate a mitzvah of a seuda with bread per se. That's covered in Onik for. And this really brings us to, I would say, get further to the heart of the matter, that even when we talk about the seuda of Purim, we need to note that terminology, because the Megillah never mandates a seuda on Purim. The Megillah mandates a mishteh on Purim. Now, a mishteh is a kind of a meal or a feast, but it's not necessarily a seuda. And moreover, not only is mishteh somewhat different than a seuda, but actually the mishteh on Purim is there for a different reason than sudas are there on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Sudas are there on Shabbos and Yom Tov in order to give cover to the day. That's what they do, and therefore it has its own ma'amad. The suda of Purim, or the mishta of Purim, is not there to give cover to Purim. It's there to be publicized, the miracle of Purim. That's quite different. As the as the Avodram, who we'll get to soon with regards to Lubisume Bepuria, the Avodram says the reason why these days were established as days of mishta is because the miracles of Purim happened through mishta. From the very beginning, Vashti was deposed, or what they've gotten rid of. However, during the first mishteh, that paved the way for Esther. Haman's downfall came about through subsequent mishtehs. And therefore, in a sense, it's a completely different perspective on what we're doing by having a mishteh. We are replicating, or we are reenacting, so to speak, obviously without the Vashti elements, but the mishteh, as part of the Pursume Nase, it's almost like the mishteh of Purim is like a menorah on Hanukkah. As surely as we light a menorah with oil on Hanukkah because the miracle of Hanukkah took place with oil, so too we have a mishteh on Purim because the miracle of Purim took place with mishteh. So the mishteh really is the Purim equivalent of a menorah. Pursume Nisa. That's one of the reasons why people begin to glow after a while in the Purim Suda. And therefore, it's a completely different dynamic from the very outset. It's a very interesting perspective to have. Now, interestingly, one of the poskim dares to go even within the idea of mishteh and say that and demonstrate that a mishteh needs bread. We're still on the bread issue. And that is the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan is one of those who's quite firm on the idea that the Seuda requires bread. And he says, even though it's called the Mishteh, a Mishteh also needs bread. And he demonstrates it from the first ever Mishteh mentioned in the Torah, which is quite surprising to think where it is. But actually, the word Mishteh first appears in Parshas Vayera when Lot hosts his guests. And the pasuk says, "Vayas lahem mishteh." He made a mishteh. I'm not sure what they were celebrating, perhaps not being noticed by anyone else in Sodom. But he made a mishteh, u'matzos ofa vayachelu, and he baked matzos. Now that's a very interesting proof. On the one hand, we know that matzos was there for a different reason. Rashi tells us it was Pesach. What's Lot doing keeping Pesach in the middle of Sodom is another question. But so the matzos are there. However, says the Aruch HaShulchan, you do see that mishteh incorporates bread. The very first mishteh had matzos in it. You don't have to have matzos. You can have chametz. That's okay. But that is part of what goes for a mishteh. One could perhaps respond and suggest that the fact that the pasuk says he made them a mishteh and he baked the matzos doesn't mean that a mishteh by definition incorporates matzos or any type of bread. They could be two distinct things. He made them a mishteh, whatever a mishteh involves, wine presumably, and he also baked matzos. But nonetheless, proof of the Aruch HaShulchan. I think in the end, there's the halacha and there's the lemaisa. The halacha is, it's a machlokas. And it actually remains a machlokas. And the poskim until our time discussed this question. Rabbi Avadia and Rabbi Waldenberg and Rabbi Vosner, I mean, all of them, Zichrono Levracha, but within the last few years, they all have tshuvas about this. So the halacha, it remains a machlokas, but lamais, I think everybody washes and benches. Well, washes for sure, and should bench. In fact, according to the Nesiv, in his Perush on the Sheiltas, the Hamik She'ela, the Nesiv understands that the Sheiltas' position is that the goal of the Suda is actually to give Hoda'ah for the miracle, specifically through Alanisim in benching. And therefore, says the Nesiv, that's all the more reason. You do not want to miss out on the opportunity to say Alanisim at that Mishneh. And the minog certainly is, but I guess it's important to know the halacha. Should, for whatever reason, a person find himself in a place where there is no bread, he shouldn't think all is lost. On the contrary, as long as he has meat and wine, he should be just fine. And back to the meat question, which is the only thing, only component that the Rambam does mention, that there should be basar, it should be a fleshik of su'udah, and the poskim actually do point out here, I'm not sure if it's stressed that much elsewhere, but here they do point out that it's meat specifically, as if to say, not poultry, but specifically basar behema. That's something that people are makpid on. But our view of the Mishteh, as we began to describe it, that it's a zecher for the nes of the Mishteh, also then has ramifications for other halachas. Specifically, probably the most famous halacha in Hilchos Purim, which is, stated by the Gemara, Chayiv Inish Libisume Bepuria. A person has a mitzvah to drink on Purim until he doesn't know the difference between what is between Ar HaHamon and Baruch Mordechai. There is a great deal of discussion, as we know. We've devoted the entire shiurim to this in the past. Number one, in terms of how to fulfill that chiyuv. What is the meaning of Adlo Yada? What does it mean even before you started drinking? What's Ar HaHamon and Baruch Mordechai? If you don't know what the difference between them is, hard to know when you don't know. But once again, the question is, where does this come from? Once again, there is a mitzvah of drinking wine on Yom Tov, right? It's part of a Samach Debechakecha, also on Chol HaMoed, actually, because it's part of the mitzvah of Simcha, but never to the point of Ad Lo Yada anything. So how does, wherefore is this mitzvah of drinking wine on Purim different than the others? I mean, where does it come from at all? And once again, the Abu Dharam says that the source of the mitzvah is a zecher for the Mishteh. I mean, a Mishteh is really a wine-based feast. That's what it is. And therefore, the specific emphasis on drinking wine on Purim, again, not as a means towards Simcha so much, although obviously it will reach that, but also as part of the Pirsumei Nisa for the Mishtah. So it's very interesting, of all the aspects of the Purim story, the one that we choose to emulate, shall we say, or replicate to publicize the miracle, is that of Mishteh, which I guess is just as well. But there are ramifications for that understanding. Because firstly, if we say that the requirement of Chayiv Inish Lebesumei Bepuria is as part of the Zeche for the miracle that happened with Mishteh Yayin, it would emerge that the mitzvah should be fulfilled specifically through wine. Well, there's many ways to reach a state of Ad Lo Yada. Some of them involve other things other than wine. But some poskim say that the mitzvah should preferably really be done through wine because it's zeche for wine. They didn't drink other things. Practically, the poskim allow certain admixtures or additions, etc., enhancements, but certainly the understanding that wine is at the center, if you understand where it comes from, then certainly that should be the ikkar. Secondly, and also very significantly, this understanding of where Libesume Bepuria comes from will result in the fact that the ikkar mitzvah of Libesume Bepuria is really part of the Purim Suda. Meaning it's not a standalone mitzvah or chiyuv of Purim to take place outside, either before or after or instead of. But rather, it's actually part of the su'udah. That's when the mitzvah really applies. And in fact, the Rambam, for example, when he talks about the mitzvah of Levesumei Bepuria in his way, he does so as part of his description of the Purim su'udah, the very halacha that we quoted from, where he says, Ketzad chova suda zu, how does one fulfill the mitzvah? And went on to say that one should have meat and one should have a suda no as much as he can. Goes on to say, v'sho se yayin ad she yiradem et yishtaker yiradem, and all of that. So the Rambam very clearly has incorporated the entire discussion of what we call the Besumei Bepuria as part of the halachas of the Mishnah. It's also interesting to note, back to the She'iltas, that whereas our reading of the Gemara is Chayv Inish Libesumei Bepuria, the mitzvah is only called Libesumei, but the She'iltas' reading is the Chayv Inish Lemechal Ulemishte Ulebesumei. A person should eat and drink and the Besumei. In other words, he's put them all together. Clearly, he has counted it within the Suda, Adelo Yada. And moreover, as the Netziv says, actually, it changes things. Because the truth is, the effect that wine has on a person is quite different if they've eaten already, as opposed to if they haven't eaten already. The very term, levisume, bisum, specifically, says the Netziv, refers to wine that's consumed together with food. Because if you have food in you, and then you drink wine, so then it has one type of effect. If it's an empty stomach and then the wine comes in, so that's altogether something different, and that's not called a besume. And therefore he explains that the way the she'iltas knows that there's a mitzvah to eat and then to drink is from the word lebesume itself. Besume is the thing get sweeter and more enhanced in that way, and not in the other direction. And a very interesting perspective, I would say, just to conclude this part of the discussion, I saw in the Sefer of Reb Leib Mintzberg Shalita, who has now a volume on Purim, and he really discusses this ongoing question of Chayv Inish Libesumei Bepuria. Where does it come from? What is it, and what are we to make of it? And so far, we've established that it seems that the primary time to fulfill the mitzvah of Libesumei Bepuria is during the Suuda. But Reb Mintzberg says more. Not only is the time to fulfill the mitzvah during the Suuda, but Libesumei Bepuria is actually a definition of the Suuda. In other words, he brings everything together. I think this is the most, I would say, organic or streamlined understanding of Libesumei Bepuria that I've seen, as if to say, this defines the Suuda, after all. What is the Suuda called? It's called a Mishta. What is a Mishta? It's a kind of a feast with drinking in it. And the halacha says, the mitzvah says, have a mishteh. So the Gemara says, well, how do I know when to stop? How do I know when my mishteh is fulfilled? The answer is, you'll know when you reach the point of ad lo yada. In other words, at that point, you have mishteh to the degree that it's a su'uda chashuva. So ad lo yada is the culmination of the fulfillment of mishteh specifically. So that's, I think that's a very healthy way to look at it as well, because it things will hopefully proceed on a much more enjoyable and less frenzied pace, because actually there is no mitzvah to reach Libesumei Bepuria in a hurry, because that's actually antithetical to what a mishteh is, right? A mishteh is a person eats and drinks and enjoys himself when he reaches the point of Atul Yadah, so then he knows. And it's possible that he can continue going. After all, there's a concept of hidur mitzvah. Maybe one can add on to mitzvahs under certain circumstances. That's also a possibility. So these are some of the discussions that take place with regards to the mitzvah of Su'udas Purim. Important to, at the very least, recognize and appreciate it as one of the primary mitzvahs of the day. From there, I'd like to move perhaps to more thematic material, but certainly we find in Purim the halachas and the themes, not much harder to prise them apart. They swim into each other quite a bit. I came across, once again, in Rav Mintzberg's Sefer, an interesting discussion with regard to the two key personalities, really, on our side in the Purim story. That is Mordechai and Esther. And that is that they both somehow have an association with a sense of smell. That's their name. Esther's name was originally Hadassah. That's on the one hand, right? And Hadassah are noted for their quality of smell. Mordechai is related to the Gemara to the words Mar Deror in Parshas Kisisa, which is next week. Which we then take recourse to Unculus, who translates Mar Doror as Meredachia. That's how the Gemara in Chulin and Kuf Lametes finds Mordechai in the Torah. It's looking for Mordechai from the Torah, Esther from the Torah, Haman from the Torah. Where is Mordechai in the Torah? Mar Doror. The words Mar Doror are component parts of the Shemen HaMishcha, of the fragrant oil which anointed all of the vessels in the Mishkan and the Kohanim, etc. And so Mordechai, in his way, also derives from or is associated with the sense of smell, Hadassah and Mar Doror. And the question is, why? What are we to make of this? That's an interesting shaila raised by Rav Mintzberg. I'd like to take a moment to raise another question, which I think is also very interesting. We're familiar with the concept of Maase Ovo Siman Labonim, that whatever happens to the children was pre-experienced by the Ovos. Every major event in the history of the Jewish people, pre-experienced by the Ovos on an individual level. And Purim is no exception. Purim also has its Maase Ovos. If we would be seeking it, we would find it in Parshas Vayigash. It's actually between Yosef and the brothers, which is interesting because Yosef is not exactly one of the Ovos. He's kind of on the border. Although one could say that Purim is not exactly one of our standard miracles. It's also kind of on the border. Ayel HaShachar. But where do we see the Maase Ovos for Purim? So the Pasuk tells us that after being reunited with his brothers, Yosef gives each of them a new set of clothes. Now, each of them get one set of clothes, which of course is perfectly understandable. They torn their other clothes, as the Pasuk says in the Parshas Miketz. But for Binyamin, he gave him five sets. And the Gemara in Maseches Megillah, Taftet Zayin, for a moment, is appalled. It's quite shocked by this. Because, as the Gemara puts it, Yosef and the brothers have just now, a few moments ago, recovered from 22 years of the fallout of one of the brothers being favored over the other. And the Gemara there mentions that the Kasonis Pasim was a point of contention and that the Gemara points out. And here he is, they've just recovered, and he starts to do the same thing again. And he gives everyone one set of clothes and Binyamin five. One could claim that Yosef's relationship with Binyamin is somewhat different than Yaakov should be with all of his children. But, I mean, they're both the only brothers from the same mother, but regardless. The Gemara says, Remez Romaslo, he was alluding something to Binyamin, namely that one of his descendants in the future would also come out from the royal palace with five special garments. Who is that? Mordechai. Mordechai Yassam Lefnei HaMelech, Bilvush Malchus, Techeles, Vachor, Vateres Butz, Vargaman. Those five special garments, and therefore Yosef is alluding this to Mordechai. To Binyamin, for Mordechai is Ishimini. He is descended from Binyamin. One must assume that the brothers were in on this, because if the worry is jealousy, so jealousy, al derech hapshat, doesn't go away if the answer is al derech haremez. And it is interesting, actually, that this then becomes the Maase Ovos. And also of note is that of the four psukim that the congregation says out loud during the Megillah reading, one of them is this pasuk, U'mordechai yatzam lefnei HaMelech. But when you compare it with the other psukim, it doesn't seem to be as significant as that. Ishihudi starts the whole thing off. Ishihudi hayav shoshana bira. Yehuda ma'isa ora b'simcha says it all, and then the final pasuk is the final pasuk. And then just before that, we have this pasuk of Mordechai yatzam lefnei HaMelech. How did that pasuk make it into this group of four that everyone says it out loud? Why are we so elated that Mordechai had these special clothes? Except this is the link. It links us back to the Maase Ovos with Yosef and Binyamin. The question is, if we may ask, why is it that these clothes, in a sense, they represent the whole Purim story? I think the question remains. We may contend that it's a detail. It's very nice. Listen, Mordechai also rode on a horse. He was led around a horse. That's also covered for Mordechai. And there's many things that happened, but I mean, and they got Haman's house. So Yosef could have led more Binyamin on a horse or given him a house. I mean, there's lots of things that represent really the elevated status of Mordechai. But somehow it's these five begodim, they're the connector. They're the motif here. But why? Why are they so significant? How did they, in a sense, say it all about the Purim story? So I think what's very interesting about these clothes is that they seem to resonate or represent a reverberation of a much earlier issue that revolves around clothing at the root of the conflict, really, between Yaakov and Esav, who are the ancestors of Haman and Mordechai. For as we know, as a prelude to and in preparation of Yaakov receiving the brachos, and of course the brachos became a bone of contention for a long time, and the connection between that early conflict and later generations, we say in the paragraph Asher Heini, which we say after reading the Megillah, we say that maintain the enmity of his ancestors right from the beginning. All of that went into Mordechai. Otherwise, you wouldn't have wanted to kill Mordechai's entire nation just because Mordechai's not bowing down to him. There's background here. And as a prelude, Rivka takes the big day chamudos, right, the very special clothes of Esther, and she gives them to Yaakov. And with them, Yaakov goes into Yitzchak, and Yitzchak gives him the brachas. And moreover, we see that these clothes, it seems, are key to, or certainly instrumental in Yaakov receiving the brachas, because the very first thing, or the last thing that Yitzchak does before he gives him the brachas, is he smells the scent of his clothes. Vayarachas ve'ach begodol. And he says, he's the one, gives him the brachas. Why are they significant? So you must appreciate that these clothes, actually, that Yaakov took from Esav himself had taken them from someone else. Who had taken them from someone else? These clothes originally belonged to Adam HaRishon. They are the Kosnos Or. And they came in time to be in the possession of Nimrod. Esav saw them, liked them. That's why they're called Bigdei Chamudos, right? The desired clothing. He desired them from Nimrod, so much so that he killed Nimrod and took those clothes. And they are the clothes, actually, that he would wear when he... those special clothes, he would go to his father. And the Maharal, in a number of places, discusses the significance of these clothes. Why is it important that Esav has these clothes? Why is it important that Yaakov should take them from him? We know generally that clothing represents honor, right? Clothing honors the person. That's a concept which is true also halachically. The mitzvah of having special clothes for Shabbos and Yom Tov is learned from the word bechibadato. Bechibadato, the Gemara says in Shabbos, Daf Kuf Yud Gimel, that you should have special clothes for Shabbos and for Yom Tov. However, whenever it comes to honor, it's always a delicate question. And the reason why is because honor, an external display of honor, must be a representation of something that's actually honorable. Otherwise, the clothes may as well just stay on a hanger. If that's where the honor is, no one needs to wear them. Whoever's wearing them, they represent the honor that is due to him as a person. And that was actually true with regards to Adam HaRishon. His personality, his level, even after the head of Adam HaRishon, his level was such that it was appropriate for him to wear those clothes. When it comes to Yaakov and Esav, these two aspects divide, as if to say, it is Yaakov who is really the one who is deserving of honor, but it's Esav who gets the clothes. And in a sense, therefore, the honor isn't really due to the one who's wearing them. Moreover, when honor isn't due to the one who's wearing the clothes, it can be an abuse. It's an abuse because it stops reflecting an elevated level and begins to substitute for that elevated level. And this begins Esav on his journey, really, of obsession with appearances. Esav is famously compared to the pig. Yicharsamen chazir miyar. He does, externally does whatever he can to look as honorable as he can and as righteous as he can. Just like the pig. The pig is not kosher, but it's got kosher looking hooves. And when it, and therefore when it squats down, it sticks its hooves out and makes sure that everyone trips over them and sees just how kosher he is. And Esav essentially did that. He did that to, with people, and he certainly did this towards Yitzchak. That's his famous charade, really, with Yitzchak, which he invested a great deal. All Esav has, really, is the outside, everything towards the outside. And Yitzchak really felt that, and Yitzchak believed him. Ad kedei kach. Which means, Rivka, however, knows, I mean, Rivka grew up, as the Mefarshim say, but she grew up with tricksters. Lavan is really the almost like the progenitor or the Rebbe of Esav. So she's seen this before, and she has therefore a more discerning eye. She sees through Esav. She realizes that he is not the one to receive the brachas from Yitzchak, and moreover, therefore, he does not deserve to wear the clothing of other Marishon. That should come back. There may have been a time that Esav perhaps did deserve to represent the more external aspects of the Jewish people, of the future Jewish people. That may well be, but that time has passed, and Esav is not going back for it. And therefore, as she makes her decision that it should be Yaakov that gets the brachas, she gave him the clothing of Esav. And with that, he comes in. The clothing has returned to the one who deserves to wear it. And as a prelude, as we said, as a prelude to Yitzhak giving him the brachas, he smells the scent of his clothing, by Yarachas Reach Bekadu. The sense of smell represents in Machshava the notion of arriving at an understanding of the quality of something regardless of how it looks. It's the other sense. It's that, and in a sense, it represents the most elevated of senses. The source, interestingly, for the mitzvah of Birchas HaReach, of making brachas on certain pleasant smells, is from the pasuk Kol HaNeshama Tahalaka Halaka, the soul shall praise Hashem, because it's considered a very spiritual quality. And therefore, as surely as sometimes you can see something, it looks a certain way. But if you're able to, we would almost say, sniff it out. And when a person, lahavdil, that says, you know, it doesn't smell right or whatever, really what they're saying is that all the facts on the ground seem to support all the evidence, etc., but there's some other, more elusive aspect, more ephemeral aspect that doesn't really check out. And that very often is the additional sense that really gives you the true quality of the matter. And this brings us to the Jewish people at the time of the Purim story, who the Gemara tells us were not in such a great state. They'd kind of given up on themselves to a degree. They'd been thrown out of their land. They weren't used to not being in their land. When they're thrown out, there was a sense of things were finished. They may have kept some things just because they didn't make a point of not doing anything, but they are basically described, summed up by Haman himself. And you have to listen when someone like Haman is talking about the Jewish people. They're summed up as yeshenim min ha-mitzvos, dormant. They're sleeping through their mitzvos. Right? They're keeping them or not keeping them. And that's why he felt the Jewish people were vulnerable. Everybody thought that their connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu would essentially come to an end. And really, therefore, the greatest breakthrough, shall we say, the miracle of Purim, was when the unexpected happened, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu made arrangements for them to bring them back, as if to say, the relationship isn't over. Moreover, the relationship is unbreakable. That was the chiddush of Purim, and the Jewish people didn't realize that, but they came to realize it through the Purim story. And the reason why is because there is something about the Jewish people that even when they're not at their best, but that essential quality is incorruptible and it cannot be contaminated. And that is the point that connects them to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And because it will always be pure and will always be kosher, they will always be connected. And that point really was what was emphasized in the Purim story. It's very interesting to consider. And the Mefarshim tell us that Megillas Esther, the concept of Megillas Esther, we translate it as the scroll of Esther, but it's also a concept of revealing that which was hidden. Megillah from the word Gilui, Esther, of course, from the word Esther. And Megillas Esther is revealing that which was hidden. And there were many things that were hidden that came to be revealed in the Purim story. But I think most fundamental of all is the nature of the Jewish people themselves had been concealed until that point, unbeknownst to them themselves. They'd been judging their identity based on their functioning in terms of mitzvahs, but they didn't have that anymore. They thought they weren't Jewish anymore. They thought they weren't connected anymore. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you'll always be connected. There's something inside of you that will always be connected, which you hadn't noticed, but you should notice it now. That's what defines you. And that was what was revealed most of all within Bnei Yisrael. And therefore, Mordechai and Esther, who really are the two individuals who are the catalysts for bringing the Jewish people back, are both represented by the sense of smell. In the same way as just before Yitzchak gave the brachas to Yaakov, by Yarachas Riach Begadav, and that final sense confirmed for him that the one in front of him was fundamentally deserving of bracha, and nothing more needed to be said. So too, Mordechai and Esther, they represented the sense of smell that always arrives at the correct classification and quality of what's in front of you, even if it doesn't look that way. The Jewish people didn't look like there was any future for them. But Mordechai and Esther, Hadassah and Mar Doror, they sniffed them out through the sense of smell. And what's represented by that, they said, if all senses are active, you'll realize the Jewish people still have everything going for them. They just need to be brought back. One could say that Mordechai and Esther in this story were heaven sent. Interestingly, this is a fascinating point of connection between the 2 days that they always end up being connected, Purim and Yom Kippur. Purim and Yom Kippurim, the two are similar. And of course, in what way? They don't seem similar. What is the deeper connection here? But it is interesting that both Purim and Yom Kippur, in their own way, are seeking to emphasize and to confirm that inner point of the Jewish people. On Purim, it's as we discussed, that's all they had at the time, but that was plenty enough to bring them back. And on Yom Kippur itself, that is the point from which Kapara comes. Kapara comes from a person identifying with their inner essence, which has not been affected by sin. They just need to know who they are and what they wish to represent them and what they wish to identify with. It's very interesting that if Purim is about revealing that which is inside of the Jewish people, Megillas Esther, Yom Kippur is also a time where the Kohen Gadol enters a place which is called Lifnai V'Lifnim, inside the inside. And inside the inside means, well, geographically, at that point of the Kodesh HaKadoshim in the Beis HaMikdash, but as Mefarshim explained, that allows for the entire Jewish people, in a sense, to go inside the inside. That is to say, to find the innermost point within them and say, that is the quality of this aspect of me is who I really am. Everything else, kapara, can be wiped away. L'chaper is to wipe away. You can wipe away something that's extraneous, not something that's absorbed and embedded. So are our wrongdoings embedded within us? It really depends who we are. But if we can identify with that inner point, everything else is wiped away. And it's very interesting that as the Kohen Gadol goes, Lifnai V'Lifnim, on Yom Kippur, he does so with the Ketores, which aspects of the Beis HaMikdash emphasizes the sense of smell again. Because once again, one arrives at the quality of these things, Buduch HaShareach, and really what the Kohen Gadol is saying, is apart from everything else, is as he comes inside the inside, he's saying through what the Ketores represents, right, you should be able to sniff out the true nature of the Jewish people, and from there, the Kapara will come. I believe, therefore, that's why the Maase Avos, right, the event, or the moment that represents the Maase Avos for Purim is when Binyamin, when he receives those garments, which then links down to Mordechai emerging the Lush Malchus, because those garments, the fact that he receives them means that he's worthy of wearing them. If the person is of elevated status, then the clothing fits, and if he isn't, then it doesn't. And really, therefore, what the Purim story tells us is that the Jewish people always have something inside of them that is deserving of wearing special clothing, of wearing royal clothing. It always represents royalty within. And that was revealed at the time of Purim. Prior to that, or at other times, perhaps one would feel it doesn't represent the true them, because even what we call the true them is not yet the true them. Purim is about the garments on the outside, the inner point on the inside, which is reflected by them, and essentially cutting through all of the layers in between. And therefore, the irony, I think, of Purim, where we always talk about v'nafochu, everything's backwards on Purim, everything's reversed, at a rather deep point, one of the things that is reversed on Purim is actually the notion of truth and falsehood, whereby what is considered to be true the rest of the year is exposed as false, and what is considered to be false through most of the year is exposed as true, is revealed as true, in the sense that what we call honesty throughout the course of the year, as we contemplate how we are inside, which isn't always as good as it should be, therefore we feel that's the honest definition of us. Purim reveals that to be false, because the true definition of us is deeper still, something that we don't recognize during the year. So truth and falsehood themselves change places on Purim. And therefore, on a deeper level, when Yitzchak smells the clothes of Yaakov, in a sense, what he is ratifying the appropriateness of Yaakov wearing the clothing and what it represents through the sense of smell. The sense of smell arrives at the essential quality, and if that's good, then the clothing fits, and that's why it's called Bayar Hasriach Begadav. And with this in mind, perhaps let us come back to talk about the Seuda of Purim. As we mentioned, the Abu Dharan tells us, as do many others, that the Seuda of Purim comes to commemorate the miracles of Purim, all of which took place through Mishta. The deposition of Vashti and the downfall of Haman, etc. and so forth. But there is a problem. And the problem is, as true as it is that there were miracles taking place at the Mishteh, for example, the initial Mishteh, where Vashti was deposed, but it is also true that there were other things taking place at that Seuda, things which were less desirable. In fact, the Jewish people attending the Seuda of Ahasuerus actually was one of the primary reasons that they got into so much trouble in the first place. Which means that when we look back at Ahasuerus' feast, we don't have fond memories of it. It doesn't warm the heart. We don't look upon this as a high point in the Purim story. Perhaps Vashti's mishtes later on, everyone feels much better about them, because the only one losing out is Haman. But the very first Seuda, as much as HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in his kindness, is already being makdim refuah lamaka, he's already preparing the cure before the blow, that may well be. But certainly if we're looking for a way to commemorate, it doesn't seem to be like lighting the menorah. Lighting the menorah was a mitzvah that we did, and a miracle was performed, and therefore we commemorate that, and we perpetuate that, and we look to emulate that. But the Mishta of Ahasuerus, a miracle happened, that's by the grace of God, but in terms of something that we wish therefore to celebrate, we should rather be looking to move away from the Mishta. And the truth is, the first step certainly was to move away. The first step of recovery was a three-day fast ordained by Esther, ratified by Mordechai. And that's just to purge the Mishta. And that's called rectification. I'm not suggesting that we fast on the Purim to commemorate the miracle, but why do the opposite? That's really the difficulty here. And we are forced to conclude, and it's a good conclusion, we're forced to conclude that no, the ultimate commemoration of the miracle, the ultimate way to celebrate Purim, is through Mishta. How so? because whatever it was that the Jewish people got wrong, shall we say, with their Mishnah, we are seeking to get right through our Mishnah. And that's why it's actually yet another iteration of rectifying the sin. It's an ongoing drawing away from whatever went wrong there. Well, what did go wrong there? And how are we making it right? One could say on a very simple level that it was wrong for them to go. They ate at a su'uda of aveira. There's discussions amongst the mefarshim. Was the food kosher? Was it not kosher? Was it shtam yenom? Was it bishul akum? Was it whatever it was? But it was wrong for them to go there. They ate at a su'uda that was really a su'uda of aveira. Well, what's the opposite number to an aveira? A mitzvah. And therefore, having a su'uda of mitzvah is itself the rectification of a su'uda of aveira. That's on a very simple level. But I think there's more. Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, in his drushes, Yaros Dvash, so he has a very important comment to make with regards to the problem that existed with this su'uda. I mean, if we think for a moment, what did the Jewish people do that were wrong at the time? They went to Achashverosh su'uda. Going to Achashverosh su'uda is not a good thing, but it doesn't sound like the type of thing that should generate such a harsh response. I mean, the Jewish people, as far as they knew, and as far as we know as well, were under threat of annihilation if nothing else happened. That's a very harsh response to going to a su'uda. And even if it's wrong, and even if the food is not kosher, and all of that is wrong, wrong is one thing, annihilation is another. But that's right, Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz says there was something else. There was something, if one may say, worse about going to the su'uda than eating non-kosher food. Because we have to remember, what was it about this su'uda? What was the su'uda for? The Gemara tells us the su'uda was there to commemorate, or to mark, more correctly, in the calculation, the errant calculation it emerged, of Achashverosh, that the 70 years of exile were up. Everyone knew the Jewish people would be there for 70 years. But there's a number of ways to start counting because the exile took place itself in stages. And therefore, Zrizi Makdimim, right, those who wish to start the count of 70 from the first aspect of Golus, the second, the third, and there were many different calculations. Achashverosh, in his estimation, felt that the 70 years were up, the Jewish people had not been remembered, and he felt that was cause for celebration. Anyway, that. So Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz says, for the Jewish people to go to that Mishnah, this is not about non-kosher food. This is basically about abdicating on their entire identity and their destiny. Because to celebrate, to participate in a celebration of what is essentially their termination as a people, that's worse than eating non-kosher food. That is an absolute abdication. There is no longer any sense of identifying themselves as being a Jewish people. Jewish people are over to join in. That's what the problem was. And one can almost see a midah keneged midah. If the Jewish people feel that they're over as a people, they may be asking for termination. Something radically needed to be reappraised, which really is what the Purim story is about. If they began perhaps thinking that their connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore their identity as a nation had ceased, they quickly came to realize that it will never cease. And that's really what the story of Purim is about. And that's what we celebrate every year. And therefore it's possible to understand, I think perhaps on another level, how it is that our Purim Suda really is a rectification of the original Purim Suda. It's not just that quote unquote, that we're eating kosher food, perhaps they were eating non-kosher food, or we're doing a mitzvah, perhaps they're doing an aveira. They were party and participants to marking the termination of the Jewish people. The rectification of that is an annual celebration of the eternity of the Jewish people, the permanence of the Jewish people, of the indestructibility of the Jewish people. That's what the Purim Suda does, and that what completely overturns the Suda of Achashverosh. I think it's a fascinating perspective on the Purim Suda. Every year we get together, mishpacha, mishpacha, ear by ear, and we celebrate the fact that the Jewish people are chai v'kayam. That is an anti-statement to the to the pseudo permanent and ongoing rectification. And indeed, as we say, the Chag of Purim is given to us in Golos, because we need it for Golos. Because there are times in Golos where there is that notion that maybe the Jewish people are just kind of coming to an end. And that's what they felt at the time. But when the Jewish people fundamentally realize that they are an eternal people, so that really gives light for all of Golos. And that's why we say, Tshuasam Hayisal HaNetzach. But the Tshua of the salvation of Purim was an eternal Tshua for what it represented. And that's why Tikvasam B'chol Dor V'Dor, it gives hope for every generation. Without Purim, there may have been generations that would have ground to a halt. But amazingly, through the message of Purim, they know it looks dark for us, it looked dark for them. We got a message then, and that's what keeps going. And in fact, I think in place to conclude with a fascinating, again, observation from Rabbi Leib Mintzberg, the Pasuk describes the mitzvahs of Purim as Divrei Shalom Ve'emes, or the contents of the Purim letter as Divrei Shalom Ve'emes. And there are halachas that are derived from those words, Divrei Shalom Ve'emes. What halachas derived from there? That the Megillah needs to be underlined, what's called sirtut. If you ever look at a Megillah, you'll see that it's underlined. Where does that requirement come from? From the words Divrei Shalom Ve'emes. How so? The Gemara, Ka'amita Shel Torah. Just like Torah needs to be underlined, so too Megillah needs to be underlined. And so it is. Other things, for example, don't need tefillin, I think, are not underlined. but the Megillah is. Now Rashi explains that the comparison is from the Megillah, between the Megillah and the Sefer Torah. But Tosfos maintain that a Sefer Torah actually doesn't need to be underlined. Typically it is, because it makes it much easier. But the comparison is actually to the only thing that really halachically needs to be underlined, and that's a mezuzah. Tosfos explained the of Divrei Shalom Ve'emes, Megillah needs to be underlined like Amita Shel Torah, means the Megillah needs to be underlined like a mezuzah. That's an interesting link. The halachas of Megillah have something now in common with the halachas of mezuzah specifically. Why? Well, apparently, says of Mintzberg, the Megillah actually assumes a role that is parallel to or analogous to that of the mezuzah. Megillah is its own type of mezuzah. I mean, what is a mezuzah? What does it do? Mezuzah contains within it the first two paragraphs of Shema. And they are really the working statement of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's about Shema Yisrael. It's about keeping mitzvahs. Terms and conditions, Yishamru Lachem. If you keep mitzvahs, all well and good. If not, not so good. You've got to have that by your door. That's your working relationship. It's a contract of relationship. And then we have the Megillah. And says Rav Mintzberg, the mezuzah actually had, in a sense, broken down in the beginning of the Purim story, because we'd actually violated what was in Shema. To the extent that what was said in Shema happened. The Chara Af Hashem Bechem was thrown out of the land of Israel. And therefore, if we had only the mezuzah, we really might think that that's the end. And then along came the Megillah. And the Megillah is another type of mezuzah. And the mezuzah of Megillah says, what the mezuzah represents is your operating relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you operate based on Torah mitzvahs, things will be very well for you. If not, chas v'chalila, things will be very unwell. But that mezuzah, that's your operating relationship. It's not your essential relationship. Here's another mezuzah that tells you the ongoing fundamental relationship is the Megillah. The relationship itself is always there. On what level are you functioning? That's up to you. And that's where the first mezuzah comes in. But you shouldn't think that there will be anything that will ever lead to you not being Hashem's people anymore. That's what the absolute mezuzah is, the Megillah. And the HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with the Jewish people wherever they go. It's fascinating to consider in conclusion that the two Chagim that we have, that is to say Golos Chagim, really, Chanukah and Purim, Chagim for the Golos, they both actually have an aspect of mezuzah to them. Megillah, as we described, underlined like a mezuzah. Menorah, by the doorpost, like a mezuzah. As we mentioned at the time from the Chiddush Arim, when you leave the house, it's to your right as you enter the world. And essentially, it's almost as if Chanukah and Purim are superimposed on each other to give you that message, one with text and one with location. The text of what is essentially a mezuzah, the menorah, which is its own type of message that the Shekhinah is among the Jewish people, together they have this mezuzah function to keep us posted. And indeed, that's really the why Purim is such a cause for celebration, not only to commemorate what happened in the past, but to give us every confidence to look forward to what will happen in the future with the Geula Shelema from here beyond.